really grateful to get the pleasure to talk about, like you said, repertoire diversity at this meeting. It's a fantastic honor, really, to be invited here. Just to bring non-NKCL biologists up to speed, I'll briefly introduce the concepts of missing self that we're talking about in a large extent when it comes to NKCL repertoire diversity in allotransplantation. So NKCLs, they sense the absence of self HLA class 1 molecules on cancer cells or infected cells, and also in the context of transfer across HLA barriers. So the quality of the inhibitory interaction determines how strong this missing self response will be. So key receptors mediating these interactions are the killer cell immunoglobulin receptors binding to HLA class 1 molecules, and that's really the focus of this talk. So interactions between these two at the genetic levels have shown to influence human health in many different contexts. And the focus of this particular talk will be on cancer and transplantation in particular, with some small comparisons with reproduction, which is sort of the scope of the meeting. The beauty of going 60 years back is that we embrace all studies that have been done on transplantation. And this is kind of a busy slide, originating with the first case reports by Don Thomas in 57, where patients, very brave patients, I must say, were injected with bone marrow. And then finally, not finally, but then gradually, at increasing complexity, transplantation of bone marrow from HLA identical twins, and then for different clinical conditions, SCID, leukemia, plastic anemia. And I think one of the key milestones really is the fact that one started to see plateau in survival curves for patients with advanced acute leukemia, indicating cure. And another key milestone is the observation that there was a link between chronic graft versus host disease and low relapse risk. More recent developments has been the addition, the possibility to actually use donor leukocytes in sort of specific immunotherapy to boost the transplant procedure. And now, given the fact that immunity is so important to actually get rid of all the myeloablative conditioning and focus instead of having milder protocols for conditioning and focus on the immune effects. So I won't spend very much time with the history, but I think this summary that Horovic published in 90, analyzing over 2,000 transplants, is really quite striking. We're looking at the probability of relapse that is highest for monozygotic twins and for transplants where T cells have been depleted. In contrast, then the risk for relapse is lower where there is evidence of an immune reaction, as in acute graft versus host disease or chronic graft versus host disease. So that brings me to the role for NK cells in transplantation. A rather comprehensive review that was published recently presented a table of all the different studies that had been done in transplants in different settings: haplo, cord blood, unrelated, and also in settings where activating cures were considered. So I simplified this for you. In this table there was an indication whether it was good or bad, or whether there was no effect of having NK cells, considering NK cell alloreactivity. And it's a rather poor reading. It's like 50-50. So this is probably not the slide you want to show if you want to recruit a student to work on this project. And when preparing this lecture, you really come to a stage where you can say either this is all random, there is no effect, and the project is dead, the whole field is dead, or you can be inspired by this, because and that's actually the latter that happened to me when I sort of prepared the rest of the slides, because I realized that if not 6 more decades, at least we have a few more decades to work on this topic to understand what's going on. And I think, despite this confusion in the field, that it can be narrowed down to 5 key concepts, where there are a number of studies that has really shown that there seem to be something in this. And of course, first is the obvious key ligand mismatch, the report from Andrea Velarde, where we are looking at true missing self. The second concept relates to HLA-matched setting, where there is some sort of activation of poorly functioning NK cells. And the third then that I've listed is the effects at the genetic level, where HLA-C seems to be very important for outcome. And then fourth, the protective role for activating KIR2DS1 in specific contexts. And finally, the role for additional activating KIRs in group B haplotype. Obviously, these are intermixed, but I've divided them in these 5 because I think they are partly conceptually different and because there are interpretations that are conceptually different. And I will talk very much, talk more about the role for repertoires when we try to understand the cellular biology behind these 5 different scenarios. But first, just a little bit about repertoires. In his Nobel lecture, Peter Medawar realized the importance of studying cellular repertoires and not only the genes. Is an animal partly tolerant because all its reactive cells are almost completely debilitated, or because, while most of them are completely out of function, a minority remains in full possession of their power? So it was sort of clear that to try to understand it, you needed to go beyond the genetics. KIR gene diversity is extreme in terms of the haplotype organization, the gene content, the copy number variation, the polymorphism. But in addition to that, the NK cell repertoire is further diversified by the stochastic expression of the receptors at the cell surface. And on top of that, we need to add layers of functionality. The degree of education, remember, the quality of the inhibitory interaction, determine how strong they would be. And also, what has been realized more recently, that NK cells also differentiate. They actually change their phenotype during their lifespan. And of course, you need to consider all the composition of all these different subsets with different levels of education and different levels of differentiation. So by flow cytometry, we've come to the stage where we can look at 1,000 phenotypes. And obviously, Amir in Peter's lab, together with Katrin Blisch, they recently showed that with CyTOF, you can look at 100,000 phenotypes at the population level. I would say to cover the key repertoires in the most extended haplotypes, we will be looking at around 8,000 phenotypes. So you don't need to go to 100,000 to get the full coverage of the KIR variability. Anyhow, so in the lab in the past 5 years, we've been very interested in trying to understand different aspects of the NK cell repertoire formation. So we've been looking together with John Trousdale and James Traherne at the influence of gene copy number on the repertoire, imprints of past cytomegalovirus infection. We've been trying to study dynamics in the context of stem cell transplantation, and also trying to address how NK cell repertoires are formed. And our group, and I think the whole field, has come to the stage where we can really study NK cells at the highest possible resolution, near complete resolution, in single cells, in unique repertoires, and at the population level. So I'll just give you one example. This is from a study that we recently published, where we looked at 200 individuals. And what we are looking at is the frequency of NK cells expressing one single KIR or all possible combinations of the seven that are listed here. So this is one individual. And this is another individual. And it doesn't make much sense. So then we grouped all 48 cytomegalovirus seronegative individuals, and we start to see some sort of distribution of the repertoires. And based on this distribution, it was possible to detect outliers. And here's one donor, a cytomegalovirus positive donor. It's a healthy donor where there is a massive expansion of NK cell expressing only 2DL1, which binds to HLA-C2. And here's another donor expressing only 2DL3, which binds to C1C1. So the education in these individuals was of these subset was essential for driving this clonal-like expansion of NK cells in response to cytomegalovirus. Just briefly point out that most of these expansions were driven by NKD2C, which is an activating receptor that binds to HLA-E. But we also found some of these strange outliers where a single subset constituted the majority of the NK cell population. And many of these were driven by KIR2DS2, an activating KIR. These are extremely stable. So if you look at the very same individual with 2 years in between, it's like a fingerprint. We can really almost mix lymphocytes from two individuals, and based on these fingerprints, detect the frequency of each population, like a chimerism analysis almost. So having discussed a little bit about the repertoires and how they look and the dramatic differences, I want to go back to the five concepts. So obviously the two first are based on inhibitory KIRs, these three are based on sort of activating KIRs. And to my mind, the ones that have a biological correlate that is easy to understand is the first one, it's the missing self, and it's the fourth one where we have 2DS1 binding to C2 and then causing reaction. The other ones are somewhat more difficult to comprehend from a cellular biology perspective, except then if you think about activating receptors in group B binding to unknown ligands. But I'll go through this in some detail. When we do that, we need to strip off all the confusing factors. So when it comes to looking at transplantation, if you want to understand anything, we really need to rid of all these factors. I guess you could argue the opposite, that you need to consider all these factors. But in a theoretical framework to try to understand what's actually going on, let's forget about all this. The second thing that we need to determine is that we have to agree on that having strong NK cell killing is a good thing. And then we have to forget about the role of NK cells in priming dendritic cells, in T cells, and killing dendritic cells. The fact that many of them produce cytokines, the homeostatic regulation of T cells. I'm not saying that we should forget this, but to really start dissecting the system, one pathway is to forget about this and really look at killing not consider the rest. And then we could do the same exercise for all of the other parameters and try to mix everything together. So when doing this, the first concept, the simplest one to understand, and I wanted to pay a little bit more extra attention to this slide, because many of the ones that come in the rest of the talk are similar. We have a donor with a given HLA class 1 setup and a recipient, in this case leukemic cells, with another HLA setup. We have a repertoire that can vary. So in this repertoire we have a number of cells, a given frequency, that have a receptor for self-HLA class 1 molecules. In this case 2DL3 for C1. So these are educated cells that are functional. When they interact with leukemic cells in the recipient, they will be alloreactive in agreement with the missing cell hypothesis. This is the simplest version. So these NK cells will kill. And you know, we could assume that this could be beneficial if all the other parameters were non-existing. So what I would like to argue, and that's also been shown actually experimentally, that some donors, they have higher frequencies of these alloreactive cells, and they are also better killers. This has not been considered in all the gene association studies. And remember, this is exactly what cytomegalovirus did to the repertoire. Exactly this. So then moving into concept two, which I find to be quite complicated. But this is in fact where the clinical data are most robust. So having C1C1 is much more beneficial than having C2C2 in the recipient, even if it's an HLA-matched transplantation. That's a very, clear clinical data on this particular setup. And yet, when we start to understand how this can be at the cellular level, we have to compare this with this. So basically, the clinical data says that this is better than this. So there are three possible explanations for this. The first one is that in this scenario, where there's a donor and recipient C1C1, we have uneducated 2DL1 single positive cells that during the transplant procedure become activated. So they become potent. And when they do so, they can kill the recipient. And because 2DL1 is a more specific and stronger receptor, we get better killing compared to the scenario down here where it's the red cells, the 2DL3 single positive cells that can become activated and kill, which is a sort of more blurry interaction. So that's one possible explanation. The other possible explanation is that it's not what happens during the transplant procedure, but in fact it's really the pre-existing repertoire. In this case we have weakly educated cells. They're a little bit weaker, weakly educated, because this interaction is weaker than the 2DL1 with the C2. For some reason that is good, presumably because the inhibition is also weaker. Here you have a stronger education, but also stronger inhibition. So when I looked at this, you know, it was when going to buy new glasses. You have the, you know, is this better than this? Is this better than this? And you think that's the trick question, really. Because it's hard to see the difference. And I asked Vivienne yesterday, go back to our data now. We have 100 donors where we looked at the function of individuals with these two setups. And this is what it looked like. So he made this yesterday to be able to analyze this. So we're looking at single KIR2DL3 positive cells and the degranulation, the percent of cells responding, those are the red cells, and the blue are the single KIR2DL1 cells. So in accordance with the rules for education, and the cells are probed against missing cells. So this is really the quality of the missing cell response against K562 cells that do not have class 1 expressed at the cell surface. So the response is stronger when the cells are educated. The 2DL3 respond if they come from a C1C1 donor. They do not respond if they come from a C2C2 donor. The opposite is what we see if you look at the 2DL1 cells. They are not responding if they come from a C1 homozygous donor, but they do respond here. So the whole clinical difference, the difference that we were looking at here between these two scenarios, is really to look at, the difference between this and this. And it's not significant, at least not when looking at 100 donors. So when we do this very simple exercise and only look at degranulation and forget about all the rest, this does not seem to be a logical explanation for the fact that C1C1 is better. So another favored model or concept that has been out there to explain this is that the kinetics is faster following transplantation to get the 2DL3 cells. So they can, if you look at a given time point, these come earlier than here. So if you look a little bit later, you will have more educated and functional 2DL3 cells compared to 2DL1. So this could potentially explain why this is a better scenario. But then again, we're faced with the fact that they're weakly educated and they interact with less inhibition. I think it's important to point out that the problem with transplantation today is really the early death during the first year. Many of them are from relapse. So if we want to see that NK cells should contribute, it must be during this time window, the very early time window. And during that time window, the cells that dominate, this is the relative contribution to the missing cell response, they are NKD2A positive and KIR negative. And that really holds true all the way through the first 3 months at least. So this is also something one needs to consider if kinetics is important. So let's go to concept four, and this is perhaps the most relevant in terms of pregnancy, and I'll touch upon that briefly. Here it starts to become more clear again. So we have a donor with a C2 and a recipient with a C1 and a recipient with a C2. And now I made these cells pink, but in fact they express 2DS1 and they recognize C2, so they can kill. And this seems to be true in a transplant setting, because this scenario is less good. There is less killing if these cells, if there is a match here, and these cells have been sort of attenuated by C2 in the donor. And finally, then concept five, where we think about the role for group B haplotypes. This is also one of the major constellations that have been associated with good outcome in transplantation. That's to have group B haplotypes in the donor. And then, of course, we can have NK cells expressing a number of activating KIRs that can bind to whatever they bind to, potentially a peptide or modified ligands or unknown ligands. It's been narrowed down beautifully. This is work by Sarah Coley and Jeff Miller. It's been narrowed down, at least in one cohort, to SEN-B. And the implications here, there are actually two possible interpretations of this finding. Either that it's KIR2DS2 that binds to some unknown ligands on AML cells. So these are the dominant cells in the SEN-B constellation. The alternative hypothesis is again a little bit more difficult to understand. We're back to the C1-C2 comparison, but now we're looking at the 2DL2 versus 2DL3 scenario, where 2DL2 are stronger educated, but there's also stronger inhibition. But this is then, since 2DL2 is part of the SEN-B, this is then better than this, where 2D3 is sort of weaker. Okay, so when you make all these comparisons, look at all these scenarios, it's a relief when you start looking at pregnancy and NK cells in the decidua. It becomes so much more simple. Not that it's simple, but it becomes at least easier. I should say like this, so it everything fits. So here we have the scenario where the maternal NK cells, or the maternal, there is a C1, and the fetal trophoblast express C2, so we will have an NK cell repertoire. This is, I should say, a haplo A donor, where there are no activating KIRs. So this is the least favored scenario. This is the worst. This is really bad for preeclampsia and fetal growth retardation, etc. But then again, if the mother, the same constellation, but it's an haplo B donor, where we have NK cells expressing KIR2DS1 that recognize C2, the reproduction of GCSF, and it's shown that you can revert the malignant phenotype up here, and this is good. And this is sort of corresponding to concept 4, if you wish. And then again, if the mother expresses C2, these cells are not functional, and therefore there is less production, and it's bad. So here, at least as far as I understand, it fits much better, the clinical data with the biological interpretation thereof. So I'll just conclude very shortly. So what we have in our hands is really tools to look at the highest possible resolution at the NK cell repertoires. And I think we need to do so in large numbers of donors to gain insights into first how these repertoires are formed, but also to use the actual diversity of the repertoire as some sort of metrics. Possibly even as a marker that can, as a biomarker for good outcomes. It will be essential to create a map and link different QHLA genotypes to functional immunophenotypes for our favorite genotypes, but also unbiased for many different KIR and HLA constellations, and try to identify the functional phenotype that correlates with these genotypes. And potentially then, if you have those functional phenotypes, to link those to past viral infection, disorders of pregnancy, and long-term to the development of cancer. So those are the activities that we're doing in the lab. We're trying to do this in 5,000 healthy individuals within the context of an epidemiological study in Sweden. And we also try to do this in the context of lymphoma. Then we need to score this. We need to get those metrics so that we can see how it correlates to outcomes. And then I have to apologize to all chirologists, because if then just to make this happen with the scale and the number of donors that we've analyzed so far, we need to bring this diversity down to just looking at the frequency of KIR-expressing cells. So it's almost embarrassing to do that. But if we do so, we look at the frequency of NK cells expressing KIRs, we can score them. And then in this case, we have also scored NKD2A, and you can see the famous sort of inverse correlation between having a lot of KIR and less of NKD2A. And then you can start adding your parameters. In this case, we've added markers that we're interested in that defines NK cells that have differentiated CD57 and functional parameters. And you will appreciate this group of donors where there is a lot of KIR, little NKD2A, a lot of NKD2C, and they are very, very functional in ADCC assays. And these groups correspond to the donors that have a past cytomegalovirus infection. But with an unbiased approach and adding more markers and being more sophisticated when it comes to KIR, I think that we will start generating groups of donors that could potentially help us understand better which are the good donors in transplant and which are the good donors in terms of reproduction. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.